Welcome to Change Hackers, providing daily insight and inspiration for people changing their world. I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I invite you to join me today in conversation with someone on the front line of driving change and transformation. My guest today is Michael Cassier, a director of Company Doctors, which he co-founded in 1998 in order to work with organizations to liberate locked-up potential and to minimize or even eliminate organizational friction and energy losses. They aim for a climate of organizational well-being best suited to exploiting potential more fully. Over the years, he's become something of a specialist in radical organizational change and transformation, including developing deep expertise in self-managed organizations. I spoke to Michael online from his office in Belgium. So, Michael, welcome to Change Hackers.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for having me.
Hi, well, it's a pleasure. Our contact came about through, you picked up on something I sent out through LinkedIn, and then we got connected and I've looked into what you're doing and it looks really, really interesting. So you've got a real passion for change and transformation within organizations and no doubt got your own story to tell around that. But nowadays you're doing consulting and helping others to get better at doing change and transformation. So maybe we just start by explaining, why is change and transformation such a passion of yours?
Actually, I started with that at a young age. I've always been passionate about improving situations. As a matter of fact, as a very young child, I wanted to become a missionary and a doctor to help other people improve their lives. And throughout my career, that's always been my focus. So I'm very interested in renewal. I'm very curious as well. And I easily get bored. So by the status quo, that's why for me, it's important to bring change and transformation to make people's lives better.
Why do you think so many people don't like change?
Obviously, there is resistance, and people are very often afraid to lose their benefits or the benefits they think are linked to the current situation. Unfortunately, it's like in the Plato's tale about the cave that he was in. They are not aware, or they refuse to think of the possibilities of what could be improved.
Right.
So, and there, what I notice is that it's very often they are stuck in a particular worldview or view on their own situation. And once you change the perspective, it's like removing the curtains or opening the window. And all of a sudden, they change, they become aware of the possibilities, and their consciousness is changed, and they are never able to go back to the old situation. And these are marvelous moments. You see that their eyes then start to shine. They start looking at possibilities and opportunities themselves. So you don't have to tell them what they need to do, because they already know it.
So who paints that picture for them?
Actually, that's what I do, by asking questions. It's very often by the power of questions is that you take them out of their mental mindsets, and that you almost force them gently to look at the situation in a different way, from a different perspective. And then what you often get is, I've never looked at it that way. Ah, really? You think so? And then that gets started a whole new process, thinking process, that brings them to consider the change and to consider embracing the change. And actually what happens in the process is that they may be a bit reluctant at the beginning, and afterwards they start running towards the change.
Do you think by doing it that way, people become better advocates for change themselves?
I think so too. Yeah, it's really, if you live the process, it's not enough to talk about it. If you live the process yourself, you become an advocate. Actually, it's like you were converted to change and to this new way of working.
Brilliant. So let me bring you back to the the point you just made around your initial ambition to be a doctor or a missionary. I suppose missionary in a sense nowadays, but in probably not in the context you imagined it would be when you were a child. How did you get from where your ambitions were to what you're doing now?
Well, that's of course a very long story, but I think what's important in the initial idea was that I really wanted to improve the lives of people. I see myself as a builder. I wanted to build health centers, schools, etc., to improve their lives so they can start, for example, the children could go to school, get a good education, and move on further in life. The same with the doctors. I once trained doctors, and one of them told me, you know, sometimes after a whole day of consultation, I need 30 minutes rest because I've heard so much. So listening is a very important skill to them, and they're not trained to do that, by the way. And but very often, the consultation with the doctor can also help you to shift your views. And that's why I set up an organization or a company, an activity called Company Doctors, specifically with the view to heal companies or organizations, even though that's a somewhat delicate terminology, but to help them move towards a better climate.
Right. So that was your motive for doing that. But where did the know-how come from?
Actually, that's what you collect during the whole career. So I'm an avid reader of books on, let's say, on change, but not only change in a broader sense, but also the way you can deal with people. And it's by observation as well. I had an innate, feeling or idea of how people could be treated. I abhor company politics, which you talked about in your introduction, and which I find really appalling, for the simple reason that they don't respect the dignity. And by the way, to make a side note, the first article of the German Constitution is that the dignity of man is inviolable. And if you treat your people with dignity and with respect, that has a huge impact. So from that perspective, it was very important to I gathered all that information throughout my career. And there's also an innate view on how you should deal with people.
So your career prior to going into consulting, was that based within large organizations or consulting for a big firm? Or
actually, I started as I'm an economist and MBA graduate, and I started in a large multinational as a management trainee to the CEO. And then I observed what was going on. It was a very interesting experience, but I learned to see and observe how organizations treat their people. And very often they're badly treated. And what you see is that there is a kind of a command and control culture in the organization. And that is actually absorbed by all the staff after a while. And once they make a career, they simply apply the same culture. And I suffered from that as well. I really noticed that I did not fit in such a culture. So very soon, actually, after my first experience, I set up an IT company with a college friend. And I became an independent consultant from that time on. So, but every time, I mean, through the consultancy, I moved on, of course, did a lot of things. And every time I came in touch with other organizations, I observed the same behavior. And that's actually what motivated me to move in that direction and work on it so that the situations in many organizations can be improved.
In your own, just that example you gave, the start of your career, what I picked up was that, you know, maybe you felt that, like an outsider rather than an insider. Maybe that was to do with your kind of entrepreneurial posture, your appetite for getting things done. Can you give me an example of what really frustrated you the most?
Well, what frustrates me is when you bring a proposal where you know this is the right thing to do, and then for many reasons, the organization doesn't do it. I noticed that when I worked at the original company or the first company, afterwards in my consultancy work, you know what you do as a consultant, you put your heart and soul into offering a good solution. And then for some reason, and very often it's a hidden agenda, they don't apply it. And that's very, very frustrating. So I said to myself, I have to do this differently. I became aware of the fact that you need to approach this in a different way. So for example, when you speak with a company, with an organization, timing is very important. Sometimes an organization simply is not ready. You cannot push it towards improvement. And what is also important is that if you don't have a mandate from the top, if the top management doesn't believe in it, you might as well just walk out because it will never work.
So that insight for you translated into a different way of working, was that a much more collaborative way of working with the people you're in contact with?
Yeah, I think you need to, so the basis is trust, of course. People need to trust you. And then you need to, look at finding allies. So my focus is on accompanying organizations. So I don't do consultancy as such, because the biggest frustration, as I explained, is that organizations don't apply what you're proposing. Mm. So what I think is very important is that you accompany them through the process. It's more like the technique you use in coaching, where you, even if you know the perfect answer as a coach, the rhythm is determined by the coachee. So you need to help them actually and respect their rhythm and let them walk the trail as fast as they can.
As a service provider to an organization, that demands an acceptance, I guess, from the client that time can be allowed for that.
Absolutely.
The basic model in consulting is on day rates and making an estimate of how many days you think a project's going to take, which makes it very linear.
Yeah,
and that what you're suggesting is almost iterative. You know, it's got feedback loops in it, and you've no idea when you set out. You might have a sense of how it's going to play out, but you don't have a clear path.
Absolutely, and you need to make that very clear to the client, that you don't know when this is going to end, and that it's a process. It's something organic. And what I notice is that very often our organizations are keen on short-term results, and they say, okay, when is this going to bring some positive outcome? And then you have to say, really, it depends on your organization. I'm willing to go on the way with you, but it really depends on to what extent your organization is ready to move along.
So across the breadth of organizations you've worked with, what would you regard as the key ingredients for success?
What you need is the total support from the management. If you don't have that, there's no way of making progress. So, and what you see very often in in organizations is when they go through a change process, is that after a while, the energy goes away. And then they're almost, the organization is exhausted. So you need to pay attention to the energy in the organization and see how you can, let's say, at least keep it to a certain level, to a minimum level, and even improve or increase the energy level. And if you come across an organization that doesn't accept that or understands that process, then your project is probably doomed.
What do you make of the, you know, there seems to be a popular trend towards companies employing change project managers, often in-house, who go from one change project to the next. Do you see that as a successful approach, or?
Well, it really depends on if it's a very small project, very clear described, then that's great. That can work perfectly well. The difficulty is that when you are dealing with culture or company culture, I prefer to work the word climate, because culture is doesn't really describe what we are talking about. So if you want to change the climate, then that typical project management approach doesn't really work, because, I mean, you of course you need to work in a structured way and have some deadlines, etc. But because you're dealing with a different matter, it may not always work that well. And of course, after a while, if they see, we don't see any positive outcome, so let's quit this because it's costing a lot of money, etc., etc. So that's why I think it's more like an organic process. And the great example is actually an organization in Belgium that is working on or adopting the self-management style. And I think they've been working on that for 5 years. And what they noticed apparently is that it was particularly difficult for the middle management, because middle management is directly impacted by this approach. So you need to give it time. And if you don't agree, if you cannot accept that such a process takes time, it can go very quickly in some cases, but that's really exceptional, then it will not work. I think it's easier to start from scratch than to renovate. If you have, speaking in construction terms, it's often, it goes faster if you start a company, an organization from scratch, than if you have to change something, because there are too many vested interests, etc. And to change those, it takes more time. Mm. What I also observe is that many organizations, they do some cherry picking on the with these new approaches. For example, in the case of self-managed teams, they say, okay, oh, that's great, because we can cut the costs of all the middle management. And they don't grasp the philosophy that's underneath this approach.
Well, I'm glad you've mentioned self-management, because I was going to come on to it anyway. You blog about this a lot, and it's clearly sort of it's increasingly a feature of your work. And you've just talked a little bit about where existing organizations with a conventional hierarchy struggle to transition to a self-management approach. Thinking of the external environment and the pace of change that's forced upon many companies now, do you see self-management as being a promising way of making companies more adaptable, more resilient, more responsive to changing market environment?
Absolutely. I think a key concept in there is collective intelligence. There's so much, and every time it's so funny almost to observe when a CEO starts with the concept and starts giving authority to his team They're always amazed by the creativity that comes from that. So it's, I think it's a very powerful tool to liberate the collective intelligence of an organization and to free the energy. Very often what you see in typical these hierarchical companies and bureaucracies, etc., is that there's a loss of energy that is enormous, and that prevents people from actually doing their utmost best to serve the organization's purpose. So yes, indeed, it is a powerful way of working.
You found as well it's a pretty powerful way of keeping employees engaged. You get very low turnover.
Absolutely. What you see, Tony, is that not only turnover is low, but the reason why it's low is that because people are treated like adults. And what I've noticed, what I've experienced, is once you give people autonomy and responsibility, actually they do their utmost best to create something, to contribute. It's amazing sometimes how far they are ready to go. And what you see is, for what we talk about in our organization, is we speak about organizational well-being. Because we say it's very important, it's a climate where people feel good. If people feel good at work, in their work situation, that means they can be creative, they can they have autonomy, they can be innovative. What you see, it has a ripple effect, not only on their own inner circle, to their families, but on society as a whole. And what you notice is that all of a sudden, the company gets much more competitive and performs a lot better.
And much more adaptable.
Absolutely, absolutely. Because there's no resistance to change anymore. Because they feel, the people feel what needs to be done.
There's a question for me, though, about how you build consensus to leverage the scale of an organization there. Is it a case of let 1,000 flowers bloom to begin with at a low level within the organization and see what works, what doesn't? But at some point, the organization makes a decision that, well, that's what we're going to do, even if that's a collective decision. You know, what's the process for that?
Actually, you have to build a vision. You have to, they need to agree with the vision. They need to understand that, okay, this is where we want to go. And they need to, you need to build a story around it so that people can not buy into, because that's a, I don't think that's a good expression, that they can believe the story and see their role in it. And what you then get is that people start adopting this, and you have a change of minds after a while, and people, it's a typical Gauss curve, where you have the early adopters and the laggards, etc., etc. And what you need to do is really have a serious commitment from the top of the organization. Mind you, there are organizations, typical example is the sports retail chain Decathlon, where actually the idea started from one particular department. People were read a book of Frederick Laloux, Reinventing Organizations, in 2014, and they said, this is fascinating, let's try this out. And actually, their idea seemed to work out well, or appeared to work out well, and it became contagious, because people in other departments say, hey, that's seems like an interesting approach. Can't we do this? Can't we have that as well? So this is really what worked. You create a kind of hype, but in a positive sense, in your organization, and then people want to get on the bus as well.
The question that follows from that then has got to be around building processes to support that. It's no good having an intent from the top, serious effort around the cultural side if there's a lack of congruence with the historical processes, whether it's around how you manage resources, R&D budget for innovation, or whether it's around performance management and appraisal systems for people. You know, what's the implications of adopting, particularly for an existing organization with a conventional hierarchy? You know, how fundamental do they need to change, you know, the internal workings of their company to successfully adapt to self-management?
Well, it all depends on how convinced you are as an organization and how determined you are that you want to move in that direction. If you look at, because there's plenty of examples, Tony, if you look, and there's plenty of documentation as well. If you look at a company like Semco, the first thing Ricardo Semler did when he acquired the company is fire 60% of the management. And then he understood that you have to treat people like adults and let them determine how to run the show, how to do their job, and let them agree on processes. A wonderful example is the company Morningstar, the largest tomato processor in the world. It's an American company founded by Chris Roofer. And there you don't have titles, you don't have managers. And the employees actually establish clues, they call it clue, it's a colleague letter of understanding that determine the way they will be working with each other. And it means that the result of that is that actually they define the processes themselves. And so it's no longer imposed from by another department. So the idea behind this is that the people know best how to work and how to do their work. And actually, a fundamental element that comes into this way of working and these collective letters of understanding is accountability. In your working relationship, you commit to something and you say, okay, this is what I'll do. And that is what you were also confronted with at the end of the road. So, and that seems to work incredibly well because people, first of all, they appreciate the autonomy that they get, but they also understand the need for accountability because they will hold their colleagues, the other side, if you like, they will hold them accountable as well.
So the other thing that's coming to mind here is around personalities. So in a conventional hierarchy, you know, it's oft said that, you know, there's a lack of diversity at the top, people recruit in their own image, or people get promoted outside of the jobs they enjoy to become managers because that's the only way of progressing them. In a self-managed organization, you know, do you see a difference in the kind of people that come forward? I mean, you know, there will always be leaders and followers within an organization, even if it's decentralized and self-managed. But, you know, back to what you're saying about the adoption curve, you know, there'll always be early adopters and then there'll be a majority that follow on later. Do you see a different sort of person come through and thrive in that kind of an environment?
Absolutely. We speak about the natural leadership. And it's something that evolves. So you have people who are in a particular project and they are considered by their peers as the most competent person in this area. So that person, man or woman, will take the leadership. Maybe a few weeks later, the situation is different and another person will take this position. So the like in the Morningstar company, to give an example, the people say we are all the bosses. Everyone is a manager. So that means that they are, let's say, called to take on a leadership role in a particular situation. And because of the accountability model, they automatically will do that. What's also nice is that, for example, in advanced organizations, they will, for example, have the possibility to recruit their own team members to determine their own pay scale and to appoint maybe someone in a leadership position should that be necessary. So it's really about, what's so wonderful about this approach is that it offers the responsibility that you give to people, allows them or enables them to come up with very powerful ways of working. So the processes are created along the way. And that means that the people who want to be the leaders automatically will not necessarily become leaders, but it's really based on your performance and your competence.
Just coming back to you then, I mean, it's fascinating work and, you know, really at the frontier of organizational thinking, you know, unfamiliar territory to many probably listening. Where do you find personally you get the most stuck when you're working with organizations? Which are the moments or the points in the process where you find it the most difficult to make progress?
The most difficult thing is always fear. People are afraid that they will lose. So, you know, the famous expression, what's in it for me? But that's only one aspect. They are afraid of, they like what they know, even if it's a bad situation, but that's at least what they know. They don't know how it's going to evolve and what it's going to, how it's going to impact them. So what is crucial is that you try to take away the fear and explain them, or at least reduce the fear level to an acceptable level, and then stimulate them to say, accept the fear and still move on.
And I presume that colleagues, co-workers will have a role to play in that. There's always going to be someone that's more optimistic.
Definitely. You'll always have, I mean, again, this is the normal distribution. You have the early adopters, and then you have some people who really don't believe this. One of my clients said, look, you have three types of people. You are people, look at a bus, for example, and they say you have people, passengers on the first row, then some in the middle, and some at the back. So you don't focus at the ones at the back. These take up most of the time. Focus on the ones in the middle. They need a little bit of convincing, etc. You don't have to focus that much on the people who are on the first rows, because they're already convinced. The people in the middle, they need a little bit more of convincing, but that doesn't cost that much energy. Whereas the people in the back, they will always be, but etc. So you don't focus on them. And actually what happens, you almost ignore them. And what happens after a while is that they either will get off the bus or move to the middle because they're afraid that they will lose out.
Right. But you're essentially channeling their fear to something that's productive.
Yeah, absolutely.
Michael, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. I've learned something about self-management, and it keeps cropping up, this. It's a recurring theme. Where would you send them a bit more information?
Oh, there's plenty of information available on the internet. Just Google self-management. We've put them on our website. A number of blogs will continue doing that. And what I noticed, Tony, is that even the large consultancy companies like McKinsey and the Big Four, you know, auditing companies, they understood the power of this idea and where the business is moving. So they understand how important flexibility, innovation, etc. are. And they see that this tool has the potential to make use of and to optimize those qualities. So there's plenty of information available.
But a good place to start would be companydoctors.be. Fantastic. Thanks again for joining us, Michael.
Thank you very much, Tony.
I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I'm on a mission to provide inspiration and insight for people changing their world. So check out changehackers.org to read show notes, guest blogs, and subscribe to access bonus content. Remember, this show's for you and change hackers like you. So drop me a line, tell me what you love, what you hate, or ideas you have for improving the show. And let me know if you know someone who'd make a great guest on this show. Maybe a friend, someone you work with, maybe even you. Just use the contact form at changehackers.org. I'd love to hear from you. Till next time, change hackers.